Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Bert Weisbord, and I'm here to talk with legendary photographer Tom Murphy about my new novel, In Velvet, which is set in and around Yellowstone Park. I'd also like to talk with Tom about Yellowstone and about his own work. Tom's photographic passion and specialty is Yellowstone Park. Since 1975, he has traveled extensively within its 3,400 square miles, hiking thousands of miles and skiing on hundreds of extended overnight trips in the backcountry. Two things motivate him: a desire to see Yellowstone's wilderness backcountry and to photograph the behaviors of free-roaming wildlife and the colors, shapes, and textures of the land. His photographs have appeared in Life, National Geographic, Time, Newsweek, The New York Times Magazine, and others. His first book, Silence and Solitude, won a Montana Book Award. I've produced feature films including Ghost Story starring Fred Astaire and Raggedy Man starring Sissy Spacek. My first novel, Inside Passage, was published in January of this year. My new novel, In Velvet, will be published in the spring of 2014. Hello, Tom. Thank you for joining me.
Yes. Hi, Bert. Thank you.
You provided the photo for the cover and six interior photos for In Velvet. What drew you to this project?
Well, the first key word for me was Yellowstone Park. You sent me a rough draft or first draft of the book, and I enjoyed reading it, and it was an interesting story. And it was also what I liked about the book was it had a really nice sense of place. You kind of understand the park a little bit, so I hope my photographs would help promote understanding of the park, even if it's based on a murder novel.
What makes the park such an ideal place to create a mystery and write a thriller about unseasonal animal behavior and mutations in the young? Let's talk about the park for a second.
Mm-hmm. Well, the park is a huge wild place, and it's sort of like my own personal experience. Every time I go to the park, I'm always looking for wildlife behavior. I always see something I've never seen before, you know, them animals going about their normal lives. And, of course, the thermophiles and other things are stuff I can't see normally. And
we should explain to our listeners what thermophile are, because I think many people aren't aware of that. They're organisms that live in the hot spring pool. And they're unique to Yellowstone.
Right. Yeah, the thermal means heat and phile means love, so heat-loving creatures. And, of course, the heat comes up as high as about 190 degrees, so they tolerate an environment that doesn't exist in most other places in the world. So Yellowstone not only is wonderful for watching grizzly bears and wolves and bison, but there's all kinds of other whole ecosystems existing in just a single hot spring. So it's intriguing to me that you use that key, that hook, basically, of the life in the thermophiles, connected it up with the larger megafaunal ecosystem as well. So it's kind of a nice cross-section of what could go on in Yellowstone Park. Again, it's a big, wild place and lots of possibilities.
Well, and there's all kinds of very interesting research being done on thermophile, and because I believe that the heat-resistant enzyme that is used for DNA forensic fingerprinting comes from the thermophile.
Correct. It originated. Thermus aquaticus originated in hot springs in Yellowstone Park. They found it there first.
What was it? TAC? T-A-Q?
Thermus aquaticus? Right. That's one. Right.
So anyhow, that was really key to developing the story, was that things could happen in this sort of wild and quite, unknown place in some ways that would be believable, but at the same time not even understood by people like a biologist who works in the park. And it's related to what you said. I mean, I guess the general question online, one of the things as a writer that's so wonderful about writing something that's set in the park is that, you know, you never know what you're going to see when you're there, and you never, and so I pose the situation of a female protagonist who is a bear biologist, and her bear is denning in June. And how does that work for you as sort of a starting point for this book?
Well, it's startling and odd, of course. It's something completely out of the ordinary. So something you want to look at more closely, of course, is that even as me, as wildlife photographers, like, they're not supposed to do that. So something's weird here. There's a lot of things that are supposed to happen that do happen all the time that people don't know about. It's like, reminds me of a birder's recommendation. It says, if the bird and the book disagree, believe the bird. So we learn a lot of stuff that we didn't know ahead of time. But if something's really weird, like, you know, they're not supposed to go to sleep in the spring. They're supposed to go to sleep in the fall.
Well, and what I postulate at the beginning of the book is all kinds of unseasonal animal behavior. And this woman bear biologist is trying to figure out why, you know, swans are going to their wintering ground in the summer and why elk are growing these oversized palmated antlers. Let's focus on that for a second, because In Velvet features a photo that you created of an elk with oversized palmated antlers. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you created it and why we did it?
Yeah, I consider it an illustration at this point, of course, with all the Photoshop manipulation, but there's prehistoric animals that have gone extinct, many, many of them, and a lot of the Pleistocene megafauna, which means ice age, large animals, were much bigger than what we have now. Like bison, for example, were 50% bigger than what we have now. And there was an Irish elk, apparently, from fossils, that was much bigger. So it's kind of an interesting, your premise there is an interesting thing. Is those old prehistoric animals that are now extinct, all of a sudden they come back. It's like, that's pretty cool. That's pretty weird. So my goal was to try to mimic on a modern elk's body something with a weird antler structure that this prehistoric animal had. So it was Photoshop stuff, basically, which I generally don't do, but for illustrations, I will.
Let's talk a little bit about the grizzly bear, who's like a character in the book. The book opens with this bear on a human carcass, and he's ostensibly the reason why this northwest corner of the park, where most of the Yellowstone part of the book is set, is closed. And he's considered a dangerous rogue bear. And Rachel, our bear biologist, doesn't believe that this bear would actually kill a human being. And it's as she is trying to solve the mystery of why the bear is on the carcass that she begins to observe the abnormal animal behavior, the unseasonable behavior, the mutations in the young, etc. How does it work for you, the way the bear is interwoven through the story?
I love grizzly bears. They're one of my favorite animals ever. And I've had similar kind of experiences with getting to know an individual grizzly bear. A famous one is 264, Yellowstone bear. And so I can relate to Rachel's connection with a single bear. They have very good individual strong personalities. They act differently. And it makes sense to me that she would say, this bear would never kill somebody. That was plausible for sure and intriguing too.
So let's shift a little to focus on your work. Why did you decide to locate in Livingston and focus your work on Yellowstone?
Well, I grew up on a cattle ranch in western South Dakota, and I know more about cows than I want to know about cows. But I grew up outside, and I really like being outside. And when I got to Yellowstone Park and did a backcountry hiking trip about 35 years ago, I said, this is a wonderful wild place that I don't you know, I'm used to being dark and quiet on this ranch of ours in South Dakota, but there's nothing like this expanse that we had in Yellowstone, we do have in Yellowstone. So it took me several years to get here, but I chose Livingston, Montana, because it's a decent-sized town. It's a nice little town right along the Yellowstone River, which is a wild stream that comes out of Yellowstone Park, and just allows me access to get down to the park as often as I possibly can. And it was the best decision I ever made in my life in terms of, you know, making a living. It's a wonderful place. I've traveled all over it, and I'm excited to go down anytime I get a chance still.
When you first started working in the park, did you have a particular focus, or did you just go in and sort of photograph whatever struck your fancy?
My method of operation is serendipity. There's stuff going on all the time. It's just a matter of I just need to be paying attention and be ready for when it happens. And I've never, I mean, I go down sometimes, like if there's a carcass and there's feeding on the carcass or wolves or bears or something, then I'll go for a specific thing. But I just go down there and something will happen. And so just be ready for almost anything to happen. And so I've, you know, I have seasonal behavior that I'm interested in. You know, there's things that I know is going to more likely be happening at certain times of the year, nesting behavior, rutting behavior, whatever. It's just fun. I go down and I photograph what I like, what I see, what's pretty. And I don't really like assignments very much because people tell me what to shoot. I just can go down and find what's nice and do the best I can with that. And so far it's worked pretty well.
Well, I would like to recommend to everyone who's listening to this to go to your website. And I believe it's www.tommurphywild.com. Is that right?
That's T. Murphy Wild. Yeah.
T. Murphy Wild, sorry.
T. Murphy Wild, yeah. I'm trying to shorten it up so you don't have to type so much.
And there are literally thousands of marvelous photographs. And I want to recommend to everybody that they visit it because it'll give a sense of the depth and breadth of your work. I'd also like to recommend Tom's set of books called The Seasons of Yellowstone, and they include The Light of Spring, The Comfort of Autumn, The Abundance of Summer, and The Spirit of Winter. And again, quite remarkable books. Do you have any advice to people about where to start on your website?
Well, first find it, I guess. but take a look at it's split up in three sections: abstracts, wildlife, and landscapes. And it's broken down, and you can do a search and just browse or whatever. But it's can be distracted a lot. I've got African material, Antarctica. I spend a lot of time in Alaska. Of course, Yellowstone is my passion. So that's probably 2/3 of the website is Yellowstone material. Again, all seasons, I ski a lot, and backcountry skiing, not because I really like to ski, but because that's how I have to get there to see this country, just be on skis. So you can waste a lot of time on my website, but hopefully you'll enjoy yourself.
A portion of the proceeds from this book are going to support the Yellowstone Foundation. Could you talk a little bit about the Yellowstone Foundation, what it is, your relationship to it, and how it supports the park?
The Yellowstone Park Foundation is a nonprofit that was set up originally over 16 years ago by the then superintendent of Yellowstone Park. And the idea is to collect money from corporations, individuals, and directly fund projects that the Park Service needs that they can't easily get funding for. And I started out the very first brochure that was produced for Yellowstone Park Foundation used my photographs. I've been on the advisory council, now I'm on the board. And we've raised in 16 years about $70 million, and the bulk of that has gone directly into the park for projects varied from project, fixing backcountry cabins, replacing, well, building the Old Faithful Visitor Center, for one thing. That was huge. About $18 million went to that. So we've done some wonderful things there.
I'd like to digress for a moment, and I think this is something that we've touched on in various ways, but I'd like to really focus on the sort of unique culture of the park, which I think the Yellowstone Park Foundation helps create and support. And there aren't very many places in the world where the well-being of wildlife is a priority. And can you talk a little more about that unique culture?
Yeah, I'd like to a lot. It's people probably know that in 1872, Yellowstone was established as a national park, the first ever in the world. It was quite an experiment, and they weren't sure it was going to work, and they weren't sure what they were doing exactly. But it's now established a standard for virtually every country in the world has national park systems, and it comes down to conservation and preservation, whether it's historic sites or prehistoric sites or natural sites. And so Yellowstone is the model for wilderness areas, for national parks, for any kind of conservation, basically. It's kind of, that was the idea that says, well, this is a good idea, and it actually works.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, about 3.5 million people come through Yellowstone every summer, mostly. And it's wonderful. They drive the roads, and they see spectacular stuff. But what they don't realize is 92% of Yellowstone Park is not even visible from a road. So the bulk of it is wild and out of sight of normal transportation. So this place that we think of as very familiar is not to most people unless you get off the road. So the culture is is still a continuing thing, that this is a wild place. Pretty much has all the, pretty much a functioning ecosystem just like it did 200 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And it's important that we recognize that as valuable and beautiful and worth saving, and it is a really good idea. Walt Stegner said at one time that the national park idea was the best idea America ever had, and I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, there's something restorative about the park for people that spend time there. I mean, they get in touch with things that they really don't get in touch with in other places. And I think it's important to stress this 92% part of it, because it's not just the well-being of the wildlife. That environment has to be protected for that wildlife to thrive.
Right.
So that there are very sort of clear priorities in the park about what you can and can't do. And that's part of that culture.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's the idea is to preserve this for its most important aspects, most important traits. And it's not a shopping center. It's not a parking lot. It's not an amusement park. Those are other places, and they're fine. They're great. But the most important thing about Yellowstone is this wildness, and it's wildlife needs wild land. Otherwise, they don't survive. And people need wild land, too. We came from wild land. Some of us, our generations, are only have to go back, you know, 3 or 4 or 10 generations, and we were basically hunter-gatherers ourselves. And so that's, culture is still in our emotional, maybe even our genetic makeup. And so my recommendation to people is, you know, enjoy the park, drive around, look at all the places from the parking lots, park someplace, get out, and walk a quarter of a mile from the road, outside of the road, and sit down. And you will have an experience of wildness, of silence, and you will see stuff that's absolutely amazing. It's simple, really.
That's good advice. I've spent, well, let's talk a little bit about the, I mean, you're the expert on the wild Yellowstone backcountry. Tell us a little bit about your winter ski trips and how you came to be doing that.
Well, my goal is to see this country in the wintertime in the backcountry. I mean, drive some of the roads and whatever, but the bulk of it is totally inaccessible without skis, human power. So like I said earlier, I'm not a big fan of skiing, but I want to see the country. So I learned, taught myself how to ski. I'm not a very good skier, technically, but I'm really good at carrying a 70-pound pack on my back for 100 miles. I always lose a lot of weight. Sometimes I travel with people, and most of them only go with me once. but I've done a couple thousand miles of backcountry skiing in the park over the last 35 years, and I was out on a solo trip. I skied from Jackson Hole along the south boundary of the park up the thoroughfare around the lake and ended up at Mammoth, a 14-day trip. On the fourth day out, again, I'm by myself, breaking trail, and I stopped for a snack in the middle of the day and set my pack down and standing there. And I heard this real regular thumping sound. And I look around and said, that's an odd sound. I never heard that before. There's nobody else around here. And I listened again, and it was my own heart. It was so quiet. I could hear my own heartbeat. And I realized that's a good thing, because if I quit, I'm in trouble. But from then on in the trip, in my sleeping bag, or I stop and hold my breath, and bam, I could hear my heart beating. It's like my head cleared out, and I could know, like it being in an isolation chamber, but this spectacularly beautiful isolation chamber. And I've done a lot of trips since then with other people, and I listen for my heartbeat, and I never been able to hear it again. There's always people making a little bit of, you know, squishing sounds. There's clothing rustling and all that sort of stuff. So that was a spiritual experience for me, in a sense, because I really, truly felt part of that place. And, sleeping out in the snow was, you know, my record is 45 below zero. That was a little chilly that night, but I wouldn't recommend that. But it's clear and cold. There's not even any airplanes flying over Yellowstone Park. So it's an elemental, truly wild experience. And you can have this basically the same experience in the summertime too. You don't have to be crazy and go out there in the wintertime.
Well, I can recommend your book, Silence and Solitude, which I have. Which captures some of the winter aspects of the park. And I'm sure that you had a ski to take a lot of those photographs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very rewarding. Winter is my favorite season to photograph because it's so elemental and clean and simplified. Sort of like the essence of the place in a way. And I like baby animals and flowers and all that stuff too, but it's the season of reckoning, basically, for wildlife. You know, they got to make it through the winter. Some of them go to sleep, like bears, chipmunks and all that. But the ones who stay out, a lot of them leave the country. They fly south or walk down the hill to the lower elevations. But the ones that stay in Yellowstone in the wintertime, I'm impressed. I've gone out there in the wintertime, and it's tough. I'm curious about these guys. How do they make a go at it?
Well, you certainly capture that in a lot of the photos. Let's go back to the book. Specifically, I'd like to explain the title, In Velvet. And elk antlers are in velvet when the blood is still flowing through them. It's usually in June and July. And during this time, the antlers are covered with what looks like brown fuzz, and it's mostly dead cells called velvet. Apparently, at least certain Asian aphrodisiac producers in the past believe that if the blood can be sealed in the velvet antler, the aphrodisiac properties improve. And more recently, there's been a growing market for velvet antlers as a performance enhancer for athletes. And there are elk farms all over the world that are providing this product. This is a subplot in the book because you have elk with oversized antlers and the book is set at a time when the price per pound of antler is over $100, and some of these, you know, a big elk can have a rack over 50 pounds. It starts, and then if the way this works is if you have a processing secret, which is a potion that is usually almost exclusively done in Asia, the value goes up even more. Just to put this in context, today in New Zealand there are 2,800 elk farmers and 1.1 million red deer and elk and some hybrids. They produce 450 tons of velvet antler per year. China produces 400 tons a year, Russia 80, and the U.S. and Canada 20 tons each. So, I mean, this is not something that is at all related to Yellowstone, but it's important that it's an important part of the book in some ways. Can you speak to that? I mean, have you had any experience with poachers or with any kind of, you know, velvet antler trafficking?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah. I spent a lot of time in the backcountry. Myself, I first time I hiked in Yellowstone in the backcountry was 1975, and there were cast-off elk antlers, not the velvet ones. They have to be sawed off, but in the springtime, at the end of the winter season, they fall off, and then they start to grow new ones. So when I used to hike for about in all the 80s up until about the end of this, or excuse me, up in the 70s up until about the first couple years of the 1980s, I'd walk in the backcountry and see thousands and thousands of elk antlers on the ground. And, of course, they belong there because rodents eat them and they cycle the calciums and minerals back into the soil. And then starting in the early 80s, they all vanished. And I actually turned in some people. I watched them throw a pile of them in the back of their pickup and reported them, and they were convicted for that. And friends who are backcountry rangers, they're very sophisticated. The poachers are. They use crossbows oftentimes instead of rifles because they don't make any noise. And they dress in black. They have night vision binoculars. They're very, very sophisticated. So it's a big deal, like you said. It's very valuable stuff. And Yellowstone is, from the beginning, has been a nursery for all creatures, from wolves to, you know, marmots and, you know, all sizes of animals. And, you know, bison were shipped out of Yellowstone Park after they did well, after almost going extinct, and they've repopulated other places. And so it's critical, I think, to protect these animals from poachers because they're taking the biggest ones. They're taking the most impressive, the healthiest individuals and removing them from the gene pool. And so it's critical that we work to make this truly a safe, secure place for these dirt bags that take stuff that doesn't belong to them. And, of course, the foundation also is helping directly with that, with the poaching stuff, buying equipment, paying for overflights with airplanes and a number of other projects, dealing with law enforcement.
And I'm sure the poaching goes beyond elk. It's probably animal parts as well, bears, so on
yes.
and so forth.
Yeah, it does. Gallbladders of bears are, for some reason or other, also very valuable, for example. Trumpeter swans, eggs used to be very valuable. You know, there's lots of things. I don't know how much they figure they lose every year of stuff out of Yellowstone Park, but it's significant.
I would like to clarify one thing that you mentioned, because, of course, you're right, that to capture the velvet antler, the antlers have to be sawed off the animal. But on these farms, the animals are anesthetized so that... I mean, apparently it's not a, you know, painful process. But it can't be fun.
No.
But I think that, you know, for those people who are new to the park, if you see, you know, in June and July, an animal with fuzz on its antlers, that means that the antlers are still alive, and that's something that... is very interesting to observe. Tom, I want to thank you for the photographs. I mean, I really feel like they enhance the book. They give it a reality it would not have without them. And I'm not going to give them away. There are six of them inside the book. And the cover is just sensational and really adds to the just giving somebody a feeling for what the book's going to be about. And I want to thank you, too, for your time talking about Yellowstone and the book, and look forward to doing more of this.
Yes. Well, thank you, Bert. It was an honor to work on that. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. I hope we can work together again and do what we can to help conserve wildland. Just creating people's interest, piquing their interest in what's going on is always beneficial.
I agree with all of that. And I'd also like to say that it's been a pleasure working with Rare Bird Books, who have published both my first book and my second, and their attention to detail and the quality of the books is quite remarkable. And I think, Tom, you'll be very happy with how the photographs came out. You can go to my website, www.bertweisbord.com. That's WEISSBOURD, for more information about the books. And again, you can go to Tom's website, tmurphywild.com, or Rare Bird Books, for more information about them. Thanks again, Tom. Nice talking with you.
Yes. Thank you, Bert. That was great.
Bye.
Bye.
Around me turned to gold. I thought I had everything. Now I'm left without a hand to hold. But it's alright, I'm okay. How are you? For what it's worth, I must say I love you. And in my bed, late at night, I miss you. Someone is gonna save my heart. No one is gonna break my heart again. I used to be a king. Everything around me turned to rust. It's 'cause I built my life on sand. And I watched it crumble in the dust. Yeah, but it's alright, I'm okay. I wanna know how you are. And what is we'll be right back.
but everything around me turned around. But I know all I have to do is sing, and I lift myself way off the ground. Yeah, but